Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg, and I'm joined with Carl Carlson. Hey, Carl.
Hey, Fred.
So we've talked on and off over these Speaking of Reliabilities about the role of reliability engineering management, adding value in doing what we do as reliability professionals. Now, one of the things I was reading, actually just this morning, I'm working through a book by Nigel Cross called Engineering Design Methods. And one of the chapters is on just the design processes. How does a product come to market, basically? What goes, you know, and I imagine the folks at Apple have a process and they have this industrial design lab and they iterate on projects and they touch and feel it, they make prototypes. There's rapid prototyping. I think IDEO is kind of famous for that, of coming up with novel new designs, but their premise is to get something in your hands right away. But it's a process that is not easy to define. And what Nigel Cross did is he did a summary of different techniques of design processes. But what fascinated me and what I wanted to talk about today was that there's a difference between what an engineer and a scientist does when faced with a problem than what a designer does, an engineering designer or an artist to some extent does.
Absolutely, Fred. I was thinking, I've got a couple different things as you were talking that come to mind. One of them is on the subject of thinking. The engineer tends to be what the creativity books call a convergent thinker.
Okay.
Where you've got ideas and facts and you converge on an answer. So you're solving problems. You've identified problems, and then you do your research and you draw on your knowledge, and you get closer and closer to the answer. There's another type of thinking in the creativity world called divergent thinking, where you start with a stimulus and then you come up with novel ideas. You think outside the box. You use creative thinking to get new ideas, spontaneous ideas, and that's more free-flowing. So you have these different types of thinking, and I think both are important. Engineers tend to migrate more towards convergent and can benefit from divergent thinking, which a lot of great companies, and you've mentioned one, Apple and Google and so many others, do a lot of work on thinking outside the box. I think there's a good balance there, and it's helpful to use both types of thinking. The other thing that was running through my brain is, why is it so important to design for reliability or design for quality or design for assembly?
Mm-hmm.
Where did that come from? I've got my own answer, but I'd be interested in your thoughts, Fred.
I think what got me started even doing more research in this whole area was, goes way back, as I was working in a factory and I was taking a handful of different college courses, and one of them was design for assembly. And the other piece of this, though, is that it's a part of the body of knowledge for the ASQ-CRE exam, is DFX. But what I found in both venues or ways of approaching this, and why I think it's in the body of knowledge for reliability professionals, is that reliability plays a role in so many different aspects of product development and product use and the life cycle. But things like design for assembly, it gets created as its own name, DFA, or design for manufacturing, or design for the environment, or design for sustainability, I think is the most common or most recent one, is that it usually brings to the table a set of tenets or concepts or precepts or tools, even to some extent, in order to enhance or optimize, say, for assembly. And where reliability gets involved is that if I truly design for assembly and make the design process efficient and fast and clean and minimize parts and minimize manipulations and minimize interfaces and connections and so on, it improves the reliability, it improves the quality of the product also. So we can leverage some of these DFX things by, one, understanding them as being one of the many constraints that the design team is facing, and you know, improve or foster those things that do help the reliability performance. But why they exist, I think it's because it's, well, one, somebody's got to write a book, I guess, but they've also seen a benefit of paying attention to particular aspects or tenets of a particular design aspect of a product.
Yeah, they're good insight. I'm thinking back to the early 90s. My colleagues and I, we used to be told that you can get fast to market, you can get low cost, or you can get high reliability, and you might be able to get two of those, but you can't get all three.
Yeah, see, I always thought the same thing. It was time to market, cost, or performance. You could focus mm-hmm. on the technology and the performance, and then quality and reliability was a fourth aspect.
Yeah.
But that list really does get really long. And I think that's where your comments about convergent and divergent thinkers come to play, is it takes divergent thinking to consider the many priorities. And yes, there might be a priority at some part of the development process where we're going to focus on cost or we're going to focus on time to market or whatever. And I think those are meaningful project management priorities and to help decision making for engineers. But for the industrial designers and the engineering designers, it's a different process. And that's, you alluded to, the divergent thinking would fit there better. And so one of the things Cross talked about in this book and in the second chapter is he reviewed a bunch of studies done about how architects and designers approach a problem versus how engineers and scientists approach a problem. And to build on your convergent thinking, as he said, scientists and engineers tend to focus on testing and experimenting in order to understand the particular problem in order to create a model or a set of rules that allows them to create a solution. So I'm thinking of root cause analysis, physics of failure modeling as our reliability vehicles we use to work in that space. Whereas a designer is faced with, I need to make a widget, whether it's a Wi-Fi router for a office building or a new handheld device for a gaming console or a new steering column for a vehicle. And I've got, literally thousands of constraints. The DFX list just gets kind of endless, right? And so But their process, the way Cross described their process, was that it's an iterative process of proposing multiple solutions. That divergent thinking, the doing the quick sketches, doing lots of mock-ups, doing lots of variations of breadboards and modeling simulations. But it's not done to iterate to a perfect solution. It's a process to better understand the problem, where the constraints really are, and are they real constraints? And it's this iterative process of refining the requirements, which then leads to finding an acceptable solution.
Yeah.
And they skip the detailed physics of failure type models from our world and go towards getting a good, the German word gestalt or big picture understanding of the problem allows them to find a viable, workable solutions. So the challenge I pose to you, Carl, is we as reliability engineers tend to do more of that convergent thinking. We get a failure, we just drive it to ground, right? We find out exactly what's going on. We understand the chemistry, physics. We can solve that. Mm-hmm. What if there's no failures yet? How do we
work? Exactly. Right? How do you anticipate the possibility of failure? How do you anticipate how the system is supposed to work so that it doesn't fail?
Right.
And that's the just let me jump in here, Fred. I had some thoughts though while you were talking. I think what hit me the most, the person who had a huge impact on me, was Dr. Deming. Mm-hmm. We had some FaceTime with him in the automotive area, and he would teach us to stop making the heroes the firefighters. Stop making the firefighters the heroes.
Right.
So he talked to management, and he'd say, you know, you all the time you're, you know, somebody messes up the job and fixes it later, and they become a hero. How about the people that do it right the first time? Can we make them the heroes? He would say, mm-hmm. and that really kind of hit me, that learning how to design correctly so things do not fail, so that the performance is optimum, so that you hit the other illities, so to speak. Learning how to do that is really important, because that's the only way you can get fast to market. That's the only way you can have high reliability with low cost. Mm-hmm. And yes, it takes creativity. I strongly recommend to reliability engineers to go beyond the world of reliability and learn design processes, at least an awareness of how designs come together. Learn the other abilities, learn the how design should be designed. So then you can figure out how design and reliability. You can talk in the language of design people, and not just in the language of mathematics or stress strength, but in the language that people are really immersed in.
It's very true. It's one of the Dare to Know interviews we did while we were at RAMS, actually, and I'm drawing a complete blank on who it was, but they talked about reliability people tend to focus on a failure space. So we look at a new design or a concept sketch even, and say, oh, that'll never work. And then we list out the 15 ways that it'll fail.
Yeah.
And we're good at that, right? And it is of value when we bring it to a table at the right time. But I think building on what you're talking about of understanding that design process, and that's what struck me when I was reading this book, and how designers fundamentally think differently in problem solving. What was interesting is just one of the aspects that was in there was that one of the steps to create a good design is to understand the problem. What is it you're trying to solve? What's the design objective? But then translate that into measurable, concrete requirements. So many of us work in organizations that create a product's requirements document. It lists size, weight, color, functionality, a bazillion different characteristics. But in my experience, it rarely includes clear reliability objectives. Mm-hmm. And I know, Carl, you and I have talked about this in the past.
Yes, sounds familiar.
So one of the things that can help a design team as they're struggling to understand the problem, this is early concept phase, early development phase, is, well, what is the reliability requirement? What would balance the business objectives, the customer's expectations, in terms that can turn into a requirement? And so help them frame that that's part of our discussion in this early on part is, well, what's this product? What's the problem we're trying to solve? And we add, and for how long, how many times, over what set of environmental conditions and so on. So we can start framing that set of environmental constraints that we're going to have to create a design that works within anyway. But we can foster that discussion. And it's not a discussion about where it's not going to work or how it's going to fail. It's more of a discussion of where it must survive.
Yes, exactly. You know, if you think about the definition of reliability, failure is only one element of the elements of reliability, what the product is intended to do, what is its function, how is it supposed to work, is an essential part of reliability. So if the reliability engineer thinks just about failure and misses the contributions that he can make or she can make on what the item is supposed to do or how it should work, that's and of course the other part of it is the conditions of use. So I learned years ago, it was one of those slap your forehead moments, that if we make a design robust, and by robust I mean insensitive, desensitized to anticipated variation and noise, if we make it design robust, it's going to be more reliable.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And so if you can work on the robust side of design and contribute towards that, you end up with a reliable design, and then you don't have to fix the failures.
That's right. And then you're not the hero. Bummer.
Then you're not the hero.
You don't, get the bonus and the parking spot and all that other stuff. Maybe, you know, thinking about it, maybe we're on the wrong track here. I think Deming was right, is that this hero idea is detrimental to organizations. And eventually organizations recognize that and solve that. That's a subject for a whole nother podcast or this discussion. But this notion of and it came from one interaction with one of our listeners that actually I thought brought up a good point, is what is it that we can do as reliability engineers at each phase of the life cycle in this early stage where it's a foreign landscape from what we do in the lab and product testing. It's very far away from it. Yet I believe it's essential that we're involved there because it helps define what we're eventually going to be required to prove in verification and other steps later, and ultimately what the customer experiences. I've heard it said, and I don't remember where the study was, but it was the something like 75% of the reliability is locked in the concept phase.
Yeah, yeah. It's the whole subject of prevention. And it's so easy, in my mind, it's easy when you have a problem to work on fixing it, but it's not as easy to prevent the problem. But that's where the benefit is. Like you say, that's where the leverage is.
Mm-hmm. And to some extent, it's understanding that there's this divergent thinking process. It's a different process than we don't have the requirements refined yet and defined and detailed, and now I can just create a test for it. It's prior to that. So this divergent thinking is more prevalent in the design community, and our interaction with that has to keep that in context.
Yes.
And contribute to it. And so part of it is setting is adding value by helping define the requirements, by helping set the environment of where this product would be used, by asking questions. Well, how long should it last? What are the fundamental characteristics of this technology over time? Those kinds of things. So,
yeah, totally agree. Totally agree. And that sometimes that takes co-location, where you have to spend face time and work with the design people, not just in a cubicle.
Oh, definitely. It's definitely not to create a memo and send it over to them.
Yes.
Well, we'll probably have to come back to other phase parts of the design process in the life cycle in general to address more concepts here. If you've got a chance, as a listener, I'll add it to the show notes. It's a pretty interesting read and about the design process and how this divergent thinking can actually manifest itself. And you may see one or more of these models actually in work within your own organization. One of the challenges we face as a reliability professional is getting engagement early in the process. And I think one of the barriers is that we have to understand what's happening there, what's important at that critical part of the process. And so with hopefully a couple of ideas here and maybe a little further study, you'll be invited to these early meetings because you're recognized as adding a lot of value. So
makes sense, Fred.
All right. Well, let's wrap it up there and say thanks for the listener that sent us this idea, and I've traded a couple of emails with you to get a better sense of it. But I see a whole series of podcasts that can come from this. If you've got an idea, or if you'd like us to talk about something in particular, let us know. Carl and I and the rest of the team that are putting together the Speaking of Reliability really benefit by hearing from you and what you're interested in. We'd love to talk about those in particular. So with that, Carl, I think we'll call it a close.
Thanks, Fred.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.